I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
I'm very glad to be back.
Mike Polignano and John Morgan are away this weekend. They're in Slovenia for a Liebach event, and they're going to be reporting about this in our next weekly episode. So I'm flying solo today, and Patrick is my guest. And before we go into our actual discussion, I do want to run through some donations and thank our donors. We've gotten 20 donations since we recorded our last one. Yeah, so 300 from Sarah, 50 from Tony, 20 from Dominic, $348.49 from some anonymous person in the cryptocurrency universe, $100 a month from Saint. That's very, very helpful. Thank you very much. $10 from Wade, $1.01 a month from Rogue, $15 a month from Dissident, $200 from Jared. Again, thank you very much, and I'm very good to make your acquaintance. $160 that came in a card that just said BU on it. $10 from Webb, $60 from Sally, $100 from Chad, $300 from Jeff, $10 a month from Wade, $20 a month from Dominic, $200 a month from Emil, $50 from Tim, and we also received $200 from Sven, and $500 from another Tim, so that's $1,654.50, I believe. Yes, exactly, $1,654.50. Thank you very much. This is very, very generous, and it gets us further down the way to our goal this year of $60,000, and also helps us fight back from losing all of our monthly donors through PayPal deplatforming. So thank you very much. So, Patrick, I understand that I and practically everybody in this audience is going to vastly increase my knowledge of Yemen today. So what do you have to say about Yemen? What's going on in Yemen?
Well, so I was hoping to maybe start doing a series of discussions, what we could call the White Nationalist Guide to the Middle East, maybe. And Yemen is where the other civil war in the Middle East is happening. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk about that today and see where the conversation takes us. And I think that if we have our usual size crowd, that the number of Americans who understand this problem will double.
Yeah. If not more than double.
Yeah.
Okay, well, take it away. So what's going on? First of all, most people, I'll wager, can't find Yemen on a map. So if
right.
you were to look for Yemen on a map, where should we be looking?
So if Italy is a long, slender, elegant boot, Arabia is kind of a chunky moon boot, right? And this would be the heel of Arabia. And so it's right across from Africa. It's north of the Horn of Africa, and it's at a very narrow strait, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, where the Red Sea meets the Gulf of Aden and where the Gulf of Aden meets the Indian Ocean. This is where Yemen is. It's the most economically backwards part of Arabia today, but in the past, that wasn't the case at all. This is the homeland of the Queen of Sheba, whether she existed or not. She was, this was a land that was wealthy enough for ancient Israel to look beyond their hatred of monotheists to start intermarrying and trading with. And the classical world knew it as Arabia Felix, the happy Arabia, which is far from today's case. But it was a very wealthy area because they had a lot of luxury goods. They had indigo. They had frankincense was on the other side, but it passed through Yemen. They had a number of other, I think all sandalwood would pass through there as well, coming from India. And they had a lot of very well-developed artisanal work. So leather workers and metal workers were there. And so they had luxury goods passing through their hands, and they had a lot of skilled workers who could add value to raw materials. And so they ended up being a very wealthy area for a big part of their history. But it wasn't the case after the rise of Islam.
So what happened when Islam swept into Yemen, or Happy Arabia?
Happy Arabia, right. So it was. It just steadily became a more backwards area. And the Yemenis were not treated so well. And so other areas became more dominant. It would fall under the sway of Egypt or under the sway of the caliphate throughout its history up until the 19th century. But the mountainous area, which is, and now this is the hard thing about talking about Yemen, is that they normally talk about North Yemen and South Yemen, which makes no sense whatsoever. Because if you're looking at a map, North Yemen is actually west and South Yemen is east. The only thing I can think of as to why I say this is that the capital city of North Yemen is to the north. This is Sana'a. And that's to the south is Aden of that capital city, which is the port that's facing the Gulf of Aden, very important port. But the Zaydis, who are a Shia group, they're basically fivers. They sought refuge in the mountains there in the, so if we're just looking at the map, the northwest corner there where Yemen becomes very mountainous and actually an area where they have some good agriculture. And they found a welcome place where they couldn't be totally wiped out, essentially. There were some Ismailis in the past, and a number of Ismaili groups passed through Yemen on their way to India and Central Asia. But the ones who have really stayed strong are the Zaydis, and now they're starting to exert their influence once again on Yemen. Whenever the powers, the exterior powers, the caliphate, the Egyptian empire, whenever they weaken, we see the same kind of I guess you'd say rhythms happening in the history of Yemen, where you have these tribes coming down from the mountains and exerting influence over the capital cities and over the trading ports as well. But it's a very important port, and I think we'll talk about some elements that have touched on the U.S. in the past. So if you ever see a picture of an Arab with a big knife in his belt, and looks like he's chewing on a cud, you're probably looking at a Yemeni, because these are the two things that you see all the time there. The big knife, or jambiya, just kind of an essential thing for adult men to carry. And in their cheek, it's something called kot, which is a leaf that's a stimulant. And it's kind of like as important to them as tea time would have been to the British in the past. And Yemen also remains a very tribal society. Your tribal affiliation matters more, even at times, than your sectarian affiliation, and certainly more than being an Arab or being a Yemeni. Now, if we were to talk about the geography specifically of it, so I talked about the mountains in the northwest area where you have a lot of these Shia. If you look to the east, that's a lot of that is just empty desert, right? This is, you know, bordering on the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia. And the culture there is also much more Bedouin style culture. And it's entirely Sunni area. There's Aden, there are a couple other small cities, and it's basically just trade routes for taking things on camel across from Oman to Aden. And so that's where we find now Al-Qaeda and ISIS have found a welcome there. It's much less populated, and that's what was the Soviet-aligned area after the British left Aden. In the 60s, they had the Aden emergency, and when they departed, the Soviet-aligned generals took over. And in the west, so North Yemen, they had, in 1962, the king died. So when the Ottomans left, the Zaydis took over, just as they've done now. And they had a hereditary king. And when he died and his son took over, they basically had a civil war between the royalists, who were backed by Saudi Arabia, and the Nasserite factions of the army. In fact, there were quite a few mercenaries who were, you know, anti-communist mercenaries who fought on the side of the Saudi Arabian-backed royalists. And the Nasserites eventually won, and a lot of the government that is still in place now are senior officers from that period of time. But in the 90s, they reunited with the fall of the Soviet Union and also the discovery of oil. The eastern area, right, the south, the ratio of people there is probably like one out of six Yemenis would be, you know, these southern Yemenis, right? So around the port of Aden and all this, you know, vast area to the east. They're very overrepresented in the parliament because it's cheaper than conquering them, and it's a way of making sure they're not fighting over oil and spend more time just pumping it out of the ground and selling it. Now, soon after their reunification, they refused to participate in the first Gulf War, And Saudi Arabia punished them by sending all Yemeni workers home from Saudi Arabia. And it actually, their population grew by 12% when that happened. And they had to set up camps, and they had, it took them years to reabsorb all these men who had been sent abroad to work and send back remittance from Saudi Arabia. And since then, they've become much more pro-U.S. in their actions, especially President Saleh is the same president who was then, at the time, who refused the interaction in the Gulf War. He's still a player now in Yemeni politics. And he remained the president up until the Arab Spring. Now, that's also an area where Osama bin Laden's family is from. And they had migrated to Saudi Arabia and became friends with the Al Saud family and started their construction business. And you know, I think most of our listeners probably know that the mosque in Mecca was rebuilt by the real estate developers and the construction firm, Saudi bin Laden Group. That's where the bin Laden fortune comes from. But he still has strong ties in Yemen, and he bombed a hotel in 1992 at the time of, this is before Black Hawk Down, but it was when George H.W. Bush sent troops into Somalia. And there was a plan to start housing U.S. troops in Yemen, in Aden specifically, and to then stage them out of there to go into Somalia. And he put a stop to that actually by bombing this one hotel. He didn't kill any Americans. I think it was a German businessman and a German tourist or something like this, and that was it. But yeah, that was the he did achieve his goal with that bombing. And then, of course, in 2000, there was the USS Cole that was refueling in the port of Aden. And that was just a couple guys on a fishing boat who drove their boat right up to the edge and blew it up and actually killed quite a few American sailors and just rendered the USS Cole unusable. So Yemen has remained a center for this Salafi jihadist activity. The Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is the most important Al-Qaeda affiliate, I think, for quite some time now, has eclipsed the Al-Qaeda affiliates in Afghanistan. And, of course, the famous American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was directly involved in the massacre at Fort Hood, he presided at the burial of the shooter's mother, and that's how they got to know each other. And they maintained a correspondence, and he basically radicalized this guy to the point where he opened fire on his fellow American soldiers. And al-Awlaki has inspired quite a few others, and I use the word inspire. In fact, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and also an American-born Bangladeshi, Samir Khan, edited a magazine called Inspire. And that was where you find the design for the pressure cooker bomber, which just over a year ago, I think it was September 2016, in Chelsea in New York, there was a bomb that injured about 100 people. I think we were in New York that night, actually, for an event.
We were there for an event. Yeah, there was a New York forum.
Yep. And then also the Nice attack, turning a truck into a killing machine was the title of one of their articles. And so, it was like a very, high production value English language magazine with, basically how-to manuals on mass killing in the West. And it really did have a major, major impact. These guys were killed in 2011 in a drone strike. And that was, around the time of the Arab Spring and a lot of changes that were happening that really changed the landscape of the country and brings us to the point where we're at today, where there are a lot of parallels between Yemen and where you have now, we talked last time about the Qatar diplomatic crisis. Now it's not so much a three-way fight, but it's still definitely a two-way fight between the Saudi-Israeli-NATO alliance and on one side and the Iranians on the other side. And perhaps the Russians will get involved, perhaps not. That's still to be seen.
Yeah, so before we go into this, just give a recap of the different groups that are major players in Yemen today.
Sure. So there are about 27 million people in Yemen, and about one-third of them are Shia. And so if we were to divide into four poles of power the situation today, it would basically be four people I could talk about. And that's a way to really keep it kind of simple and so our listeners can follow along. And I'll just refer to them by their last names, and I'll spell their last names, but just to keep it simple, I'll do that. So Saleh, S-A-L-E-H, was the president from unification until the Arab crisis, until the Arab Spring. And Hadi was the vice president who dreamed of becoming president. I want to talk about a general named General Ammar. General Ammar. So President Saleh, Vice President Hadi, General Ammar, and then finally the Houthi faction that we hear so much about in the news, who are the Shia faction. Now, the president, he's a secular guy. You know, he's definitely from a very young age, a Nasserite to the core, right? An Arab nationalist. He's very secular, but he's from a Shia background. And he also happens to be from the largest tribal alliance, the Bakil Tribal Alliance, which is like 8 million people there. So we're talking that's over a quarter of the country belongs to this one tribal alliance. And he was the president until the Arab Spring happened. And then they set up a situation where he steps back. There was a lot of internal fighting because he wanted to pass presidentship onto his sons. And what started out as he was elected by a free and fair election, he became president for life, as so often happens in Africa. And actually, the tribal aspect of Yemeni politics is really much more like you'd find in Africa in many ways. But yeah, that's very important. He's part of the largest tribe. Now, the vice president was a senior politician from the south, from the former capital, Aden, right? This port that faces out, this major port city. Sana'a is the current capital and was the capital that Saleh started at. And actually, it's funny, Sana'a was really like the go-to place for Americans or anybody else who wanted to learn Arabic for years and years. I mean, for easily the first 10 years after 9/11 happened up until the Arab Spring, because it was cheaper to live at than anywhere else, and because their Arabic was comprehensible everywhere in the Arab world. Whereas if you went to like Morocco, you'd have an accent that can't be understood on the other side of the Arab world, right, or vice versa. Egypt was too expensive, so lots of people went to Sana'a. So you have these cases where the Kouachi brothers, for example, and the underwear bomber, they were in Sana'a to learn Arabic. And also probably, who knows, like a quarter, maybe a half of FBI and CIA agents who wanted to become Arabists, right, or diplomats, would go there. Spend a year in college to go there and learn Arabic. And so I think, more and more you're seeing these weird connections, kind of like how you had with, Barry Seal, right? There's a movie that just came out about him, the drug smuggler who was linked to the CIA. He was in the same Civil Air Patrol as Lee Harvey Oswald and some guy who was involved with the Cuban circle, right? And they just happened to be in the same Civil Air Patrol in Baton Rouge at a time when, people were being recruited for this kind of stuff in that area. And you're going to find all these connections with people who went to Sana'a for this decade to learn Arabic. Now, I'm sure there are no foreign students there at all. But anyway, you have the president, Saleh. You have the vice president, Hadi. Hadi from the south. He's a Sunni. He was trained by the Soviets. So the Sunnis like him, but not this, he's not like the Salafist guy, right? Because he's not at the core a Sunni fundamentalist at all. But when the Arab Spring came, he sought refuge in Saudi Arabia. He skipped town, right? And he went to Saudi Arabia for protection. And then he came back and he became shortly thereafter the NATO recognized president. Now I mentioned there was a general who's very important, and this guy is Ammar, A-H-M-A-R. And he's from the second largest tribe. He's a fixer for that tribe. He's from the north, right? He's from Sana'a itself, actually. And he's a Sunni, not a Shia. And actually, supposedly, he has very positive attitudes and relations with Salafists. And he as well, when the Arab Spring came, he, first of all, he refused to follow the orders of the president. And he turned his troops, his tank corps, against the president. And then he sent his family to Saudi Arabia for protection and then came back and was and this guy is a very, very important general in the history of Yemen because they have civil wars just all the time. I mean, in the 90s, they had a major civil war. In throughout the 2000s, there were lots of small conflicts. And this guy has spent like 30 years in what is the Houthi territory, fighting these Houthi separatists and or Zaydis, right? These Shia who were kind of comparable to Hezbollah, like maybe. And it's not a perfect comparison, but pretty comparable. So he turned against the president. He has these strong links with Saudi Arabia. He is from the second most important tribe, which also withdrew its support from the president. And it then comes back, and he's just too powerful for Hadi to handle, the former vice president, who's now the NATO-backed president. He gets fired. Now, he gets called back not that long afterwards because of his expertise in fighting in this area. And so, I'm skipping something too. This guy, Ammar, before he turned on the president allegedly gave Saudi Arabia his coordinates when Saudi Arabia was helping with air attacks against Shia extremists in the hopes that they would kill this guy and rid him of this powerful element within his government, right, that he was afraid he couldn't control. So everyone's afraid they can't control this guy, but the current president, who's the NATO-backed one, just needs him to survive, and so he's sticking with him. And they have a very uneasy alliance. So then, now let's enter, the Houthis, right? These guys who are, more Shia, religiously inspired. And they come from this mountainous area. And now the funny thing about them is that their name is actually, it's not the real name that they use. And it's kind of like if we were to talk about the Tea Party and call them Paulists or Pauls, like they're from the Ron Paul family. Mm-hmm. It's just that the Houthi family is the royal family of this Shia sect. And most of the tribes, actually, they're a small minority as a clan or a tribe compared to all the other tribes. But they have this vaunted status because they're descended from this, for what for them was the last Imam, the fifth Imam. And when people talk up against them now, they're saying like, oh, well, you don't want to go back to what it was like before 1962, where the only way you had a say in society is if you were a Sayyid, if you were a Sayyid, meaning a descendant of Muhammad. So it's used that way against them, right? But it's really started out as a kind of student movement in the 1990s, where they would just have book clubs and gatherings and things like this. And they would just, to kind of build their support among students and develop interest in history and theology and things like this. And then, slowly they developed in a more political direction. It's like, oh, well, let's do this, and then let's go out and chant death to America, death to Israel outside of the embassy after our book club meeting, And so they would, became more and more popular and have kind of set fire to the hearts of all the Shia throughout the country, which, happens every, 100 years or so whenever the exterior powers can't project power inwards into Yemen anymore. And so these people who were making war and, they were running an insurgency against Saleh, right? This president who was trying to be president for life and trying to pass on the presidency to his kids. They were making war against him all the last decade. But now that he's out of power, the way he's, Saleh has decided the way he's going to get back into power is to promise a federal Yemen. And so now he's allied with the Houthi. So on that side as well, there's this very uneasy alliance between these two sides. And so you have on the NATO-backed side, you have this vice president who's from the south, who represents their interests from Aden. And he's teamed up, the way he's trying to build his necessary coalition to win is he's teamed up with a guy who's the fixer, right? The boy who made good from the second biggest tribe, who's a Sunni, who's from Sana'a, the northern capital, and who, and he was a rival of the previous president's sons, and is a military expert. Hadi brings the diplomacy, he brings these international connections, and Ammar, the general, brings his military expertise, his ability to remove the support of the second largest tribe from the previous president, and his ability to extend the hand of friendship with the Salafis. And then on the other side, your uneasy alliance is between a Nasserite who's trying to pass the presidency on to his sons, who's a secular Shia, and the fundamentalist Shia of the Ansar al-Islam, the Houthi faction.
So what are the external powers involving themselves in this Yemen conflict?
Right. So in 2014, so, you know, it was just kind of an uneasy. There's a big power vacuum for the years following the Arab Spring. And it was just, you know, the governments kind of broke down, right? Just things weren't happening the way they should. And what I mean by that is that, you know, trash isn't getting picked up. You know, the soldiers are not, who are supposed to be standing guard are not standing guard, right? You know, they might be somewhere around with their uniforms, you know, waiting for food to show up. But just things stop moving, right? The machine stops working. It's in 2014 that the Houthis swept down from the mountains and took the capital. And it's in 2015, the very next year, that the Gulf Cooperation Council. So we talked a lot about these states along the Persian Gulf, the Gulf Cooperation Council. And of course, the most important country there is Saudi Arabia. So they sent in troops in a coalition. And they also started doing an air war against them. And that's been, you know, not terribly successful, frankly. They've killed over 10,000 civilians. They don't have much to show for it. The Houthis made it all the way down to Aden, which is really shocking. I mean, that's way, way beyond their heartland. And the Saudis and the, you know, even, for example, the United Arab Emirates, they hired, I think, about 500 Colombians to go fight for them, because they just, you know, these royal countries, these monarchist countries, find it incredibly difficult to have an army. You know, citizen armies are just so much more effective than armies run by these monarchies. So all of the most populated area of Yemen remains under the control, more or less, of the Houthis. Now, it's not, you know, the government is not functioning well at this point, which leads us to a big crisis in 2016. But they remain largely in charge of the vast majority of the population.
Yeah, so they hold a minority of the country, but the majority of the population. And basically, it looks like they control what used to be called North Yemen.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, and so there's a port, and this is really amazing, too, that, I mean, we're talking about, you know, basically, you know, guerrilla fighters from the mountain. Now, because they have this backing of the Iranians, they've gotten what are much like Scud missiles, right, that Saddam was using, smuggled into their territory. And they are shooting these into Saudi Arabia from time to time. In particular, right before the last two Hajj pilgrimages, right? So this is really the one time of the year when all the eyes of the Muslim world are on Saudi Arabia is during the Hajj, when you have this, you know, this swarm of humanity descends upon this one little rock. And if you were to look at a map of Saudi Arabia, not very far from there, just up the mountains from there to the, I think it's like southwest or west by southwest, is a city called Ta'if. And that is the most important city for the Air Force and a lot of other military material for the Saudi Arabians. It's also the summer palace is there for the king. And so in the summertime in 2016 and 2017, the Houthis were successful in sending missiles there and landing them there at the heart of, well, this same air force that's running sorties over Yemen, which is an incredible projection of power. And actually this past year, they were even capable of sending a missile as far as Riyadh, the capital. So that means that the capital, the most important port, Jeddah, their military base, the most important military base, Ta'if, and Mecca are all within their range.
Well, this is very interesting because I would imagine that the House of Saud would pretty much lose all of its legitimacy if it cannot protect Mecca from missiles raining down on it. That's what they're supposed to be, right? The protectors of Mecca.
Yes, right. That's part of his title. You're right. Yeah, he's like the king of Saudi Arabia and the protector of the two holy mosques. That's right. That's who he is. And so you're absolutely right. If they fail to do this, they lose that legitimacy. And it's also, I mean, what happens is that it scares away people from the pilgrimage. And this is a big point for the Shia. The two things is that Saudi Arabia in the past, you know, they've had so many deaths during the Hajj. just because people get riled up and they're not, there's poor crowd control. And so you have, you know, year after year, hundreds of people die in being trampled to death. And so they had a major redesign a few years back, actually, to try and reduce this. But even since the major redesign, I mean, it looks like, you know, you're looking at the Los Angeles highway system, you know, from the sky. And it's really crazy what they set up. But yeah, they still have failed to, you know, have a bloodless Hajj in quite some time. And then on, you add to that the instability in the region, the inability to, inability to protect them from others. Now, I think also, you know, the Houthis would be a lot of people's least favorite people in the world if they were to blow up Mecca as well. So I don't think they would do that, but the airports in Taif, where a great many pilgrims come into, or Jeddah, where a great many pilgrims come into, you know, that would be considered a legitimate target, I think, by a lot of people. Wouldn't be the same kind of sacrilege, right, as blowing up Mecca would be. I mean, that would ruin the Hajj totally. So that's, you know, that's one part of it. So yeah, the Saudi Arabia, and I think we'll talk about this next spring. So the word is that they might be having a peaceful passage of power from father to son. And this would be the first time that they go from one generation to the next in like, I don't know, 70 years or so. Cause you know, Bedouins, they don't have primogeniture. They have seniority. They pass power from the eldest brother to the next eldest brother to the next eldest brother. And they've just run out of sons of the last generation. Al Saud, actually, you know, King Saud. And so, you know, this is a big deal because, you know, suddenly a whole lot of Saudi princes are going to be demoted in a very big way. You know, they're no longer going to, you know, their descendants will be no chance of ever becoming king of Saudi Arabia and pretty poor chance of ever becoming a minister. But the son is basically in charge of day-to-day politics. So that's why you see all these changes lately. Like they've announced women can drive soon. They've, you know, the Qatar crisis, this foreign policy in Yemen, the intervention in Yemen. And so this, and also he's announced he wants to send, put Saudi Aramco on the public market, the oil company. So big changes are in store, but they're failing to do this. And every dollar that they have to spend on this is a dollar that they don't spend building a new mosque in London or buying school books for a private school in, you know, Falls Church, Virginia, right?
What are they failing at? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Saudis are failing in the Qatar crisis to exert diplomatic force over the Qatari, their Qatari neighbors, and they're failing to exert military force over Yemen.
Are the Houthis basically just a proxy for Iran?
In many ways, yes. In many ways, yes. You know, one of the reasons that it's said why Jimmy Carter was not more active in supporting the Shah was the Shah was providing support to these very same people. And the king of Saudi Arabia at the time was very concerned about this and asked Jimmy Carter to kind of step back from supporting him until he withdrew support for these Shia on their border. And so, and that led to the fall of the Shah, right? Now it's the same story all over again. Iranians are very involved in this process. And in fact, the port city of Hodeidah on the Red Sea has been shut down both by the Saudi Arabians and by a U.S. naval blockade for fear of weapons from Iran being transported into, you know, what's called North Yemen, right? This western part of the country. And what's happened as a result of that, so a mixture of the, you know, the one thing that the Saudis have been successful at is dropping bombs on water sanitation plants and on hospitals. And they actually created this past year the greatest cholera epidemic ever recorded as a result. And despite the fact that that port remained shut the entire time, luckily for the Yemenis there, the Red Cross and the World Health Organization were, you know, really active. They had over 600,000 cholera cases, actually, but they kept deaths down to about 2,000. But, and the irony is, too, that, you know, when I look at the map of where they say the number of cases were, it really seems to have fallen disproportionately on heavily Sunni areas where you have more urban populations. And I think a lot of the Houthi heartlands were untouched by this epidemic, in fact. I think in the end, it actually made them stronger. And not so long ago, they had a big Independence Day celebration in Sana'a. Now, the Houthis and the Saleh faction had two separate events. But yeah, I mean, things seem to be working in working order again. But, you know, I guess the thinking about, you know, what's coming in terms of the share of power, you know, if Hadi dies, right, the guy, the VP from the South, right, who's now the NATO-backed president, if Hadi dies, the South has interest. They're going to just take whoever is the next senior politician and put him in place. If Saleh dies, everybody who's backing Saleh, right, this president for life, knows that he's there to pass power to his sons. And so when he dies, power's going to be passed to his sons, and there aren't going to be any shocked people who pack up and leave. You know, because it's a lot of basically government employees who are more loyal to him and who get more stuff from him than they do from the other guy, Hadi, right? This is basically a factional fight of this kind. The Houthis are always going to be Shia, right? They're always going to, that's not going to change. They could kill their charismatic leader in place now, and he'll be replaced by somebody else with a great lineage and a nice speaking voice, right? This is the Shia way after all. But I think that the one person who may be the indispensable man would be the general Ammar, because his ability, his military knowledge, the loyalty that he has from his men, the ability to arrange things with the second largest tribe and to basically be the fixer for them, to decide for them in their best interest and to be trusted to do so, and also to have a positive relationship with the Salafis, I think it would be really difficult to find somebody who has all these things and who would be able to keep together the coalition of loyalists that he has. And so I think that I think that if he were to die, or if he were to, that would be a big game changer. And I think he's more important even than his boss, the President Hadi, Hadi, from the South. Now, the other thing that's interesting is with these missiles going into Yemen, from Yemen into Saudi Arabia, we're talking here at the end of October 2017. In early October, Saudi Arabia had its very first ever state visit to Russia. And that was a really big deal. It's a big deal because the U.S. relationship was, for so long, has been really a patron-client relationship. And they expected complete loyalty and backing. And the U.S. expected, you know, what the U.S. expects in return. And because Saudi Arabia has been forced to be so much more proactive in suppressing the Arab Spring in Bahrain by sending in tanks, through the Qatar crisis, through what's happening in Yemen, they opened up towards new alliances and reached out to the Russians. They signed, I think it was over $100 billion in deals. They'll be buying gas from the Russians, because they'd rather get gas from Russia than their Arab neighbors and be dependent on them, because they have a lot of oil but not a lot of gas. They want to change their power plants. It sounds crazy, but they want to have the upper hand over the Qataris. Yeah. And then the other thing is, and this was the most amazing thing, is you could almost do a show on the importance of anti-aircraft missiles in Russian diplomacy, but they agreed to sell them S-400 anti-aircraft missiles, right? And these are really, I mean, they haven't sent any abroad yet. They're using them in Syria right now. And they're also using this S-300s in Syria and Iran. They've actually sold them to the governments of Syria and Iran. And do you remember, I think a lot of our young listeners probably don't remember, in the first Persian Gulf War, the Patriot missiles were used to take down Scuds, and it was really talked about a lot. You remember that, right? And they had parades where they had like the Patriot missiles on wagons, you know, taking them through small towns and talking about how this is what's, you know, kept peace throughout the entire Middle East. This is what prevented war from spreading. Now, it's not so certain since then. There have been a lot of doubts about how effective it is, actually. And a lot of people have said, well, maybe those Scuds were just poorly made and were breaking up in the atmosphere, right? And the attitude is that those were not so effective, actually. Now, the S-300s, this is the previous generation, can actually take down F-15 aircraft. And if you remember, it was back in 2006, right? the Syrians were trying to build a nuclear plant. And the Israelis came in and blew it up. And the weirdest thing is there was no press conference. Syria didn't complain because they were doing something wrong, and they didn't want people to know they're doing something wrong. So even if, you know, even though a neighboring country violated their airspace, blew up their stuff, they said nothing at all, right? Well, this past year, last spring, they actually, according to the Syrians, not according to the Israelis, they actually successfully blew up an Israeli F-15 flying in their airspace using S-300, the previous generation of Russian anti-missile and anti-aircraft weapons, right? So this really changes the balance of power. And the Israelis have insisted on getting the better, better aircraft, but the S-400 can actually take those down. So if you move S-400 into Saudi Arabia, that means that Israel has no upper hand over Saudi Arabia, right? It means that Israeli planes cannot violate Saudi airspace. And it would also, I mean, they're sensibly bringing these in to stop these Yemeni missiles. They made the deal because they're afraid that Russia, as they did in Syria, might invest a very little amount to get a very great deal back in terms of their clout in the world. And so to prevent that, that's why this trip happened, and that's why they made this deal. When Syria is ending, the civil war there is winding down. The jihadists are leaving there. Some are going to Yemen. Some are going, allegedly, they're trying to bring a lot of them into Burma to fight against this Rohingya expulsion. But, this is the other place where a lot will be determined in terms of this Zionist-Salafist alliance, right? And if Saudi Arabia fails, it's easy for these very unlikely allies to stand together when times are good. But as times get bad, hopefully that alliance can be broken apart.
So how does this influence or affect American interests and more broadly just white ethnic interests around the world?
In terms of American interests, it's really about, having more satraps, right? More of these countries that just have American bases and don't rock the boat for the oligarchy. But, the problem is that the American government is, in my view, a Zionist-occupied government, is the old phrase, ZOG. And, weakening that oligarchy is, by any means, is a step in the right direction, because ultimately these oligarchs need to be removed and replaced by people representing our people. And the alliance that's working together with them, this Saudi Arabian-Israeli alliance that's exerting power throughout the region, is ultimately the bane of our race. I mean, without them, there wouldn't be jihadist terror, and there wouldn't be the refugee crisis. And so I think that weakening these two sources of power would weaken the two greatest sources of evil that afflict Europe and whites in North America. I mean, obviously there are other things, affirmative action is bad, but I mean, apart, jihadist terror, the invasion of Europe, the ability for the organized Jewish community to kind of play things both ways by destroying us from within with their diaspora and, engaging in the kind of connivance they do with their own, by having their own state in Israel. We have to take that ability away from them, and by forcing them to spend all of their capital to bring the people back into Israel and to protect them is it's a worthy goal. And so that's why I'm interested in what's happening in Yemen, and that's why I think that the stronger the Houthis are, I'd say what's roughly speaking, if the Houthis have what they want, which would be a federal democratic Yemen, in which they have essentially control over their own area and the way that Hezbollah has in Yemen, and if they are a powerful force with their own militia, with their own missiles on the border of Saudi Arabia, this can only be good for us.
Well, that's very interesting. Many of us had not heard of the Houthis, and I hope now some of us are going to be rooting for them. I do think that anything that destabilizes the Judeo-American hegemony in that part of the world, and also the Saudi monarchy and the Saudi monarchy's alliance with all these jihadi type groups, I think is only going to redound to white interests in Europe and America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agreed.
Well, great. Are there any last thoughts about this? Anything that you think we should watch for? Anything that we should read to inquire further into this?
Well, I think that the big thing that's going to happen probably is, I mean, the big things to look out for in 2018 are the final conclusion of the Syrian civil war. We know that all of their major urban centers that they were holding have fallen. I think there's only one remaining oil-rich area that ISIS holds that's left to fall. And then, of course, they have the mountains to escape into. But it seems that 2018 may be the very end of this. It seems that the U.S. ability to project power into a final settlement in Syria will be limited, and because ultimately, unfortunately for the Kurds, and I think for those who have kind of cheer them on, looks like the Assad will basically get everything he wants, and not get the Kurds won't really get much out of it in terms of a devolved power. And also because, the devolved power to the Kurds, the fear would be this would be a tool for America to project power. But I can tell you there are a lot of white nationalists who have actually went and joined the Kurds in their fight there for the chance of killing ISIS soldiers. And the other thing to look out for is the change of power in Saudi Arabia. And that can only bring incredible instability, because I think what he's proven is that Saudi Arabia might be a paper tiger, and their greatest enemies historically have actually been internal enemies, and that's the extremists within who they've done so much to cultivate, and are also the greatest threat to that family. They're really dancing with a bear, basically, the Saud family and the Wahhabi Salafist Islamists there. And so those are the things I'd look out for in 2018.
Well, that is very, very exciting. So, yeah, we do definitely live in interesting times. Honestly, anything that destabilizes the current global system, I think, is of benefit to whites.
Absolutely.
So we'll keep watching, and we'll have you back for another installment in this sort of ongoing discussion of various flashpoints in the Muslim world. Yeah, so thank you very much.
Excellent. Yeah, very glad to be here. And thank you so much to the supporters who have helped Countercurrent survive in these difficult times, because it couldn't happen without you. So thank you so much.